Hi, Gagamoy.
That's a Nias phrase meaning, where are you going?
Hi, Gamoroy.
Where are you coming from? These are phrases you'll hear every day if you cross paths with a Nias villager. They're more like polite formalities than actual questions. Similar to when we say something like, what's up, dude? And when I answer with Mondiasi, which means taking a bath in the sea, that's a colorful way the older generation describes surfing. And from the beginning, the act of riding waves has never ceased to amaze and fascinate the Nias Islanders. My name is Phil Goodrich, and this is A Surfer's Path, Episode 2. Somehow, Nias culture went from terrifying headhunters and shamans to predominantly Christian in just a few generations. Their fantastic mythical origin stories somehow morphed perfectly to accept the radical stories within the Christian Bible. It was Niasian curiosity and willingness to learn from the Western world that laid the groundwork for the first surfers to arrive and thrive in 1975. In episode 1, I told you about the anthropologist Elio Modigliani and his amazing experience with the fierce tribes of southern Nias in 1886. It was the map Modigliani made that paved the way for the Dutch colonizers to finally make peace with the tribes and to build a road into the south that allowed Christian missionaries to safely arrive and share their faith. In this episode, I'm going to tell you the fantastic story of the first three surfers to discover and surf the legendary waves of Lagoondry Bay. Even though Christianity had spread through the island and was the majority, there were still some stalwart renegades from deep in the jungle that held on to the traditional values of black magic and headhunting. While the young explorers were deep in the bliss of discovering virgin tunnels, there was an undercurrent of evil, a plot to take their heads. This duality of heaven and hell, good and evil, triumph and tragedy, is a theme that seems to be inescapable when it comes to traveling to Nias. Have you ever seen a photograph that changed your life? Or more specifically, has a photograph from a surfing magazine ever haunted your subconscious or changed the trajectory of your path on Earth? When I was 11 years old and surfing was still brand new to me, I got my first surf magazine and I saw a photo of a wave like nothing I had ever imagined. The color of the water was technicolor turquoise, and there were palm trees directly behind the wave, partially obscured by offshore wind blowing plumes of mist up the lip. Under the photo was a four-letter word, N-I-A-S, Nias. That word meant nothing to me at the time. It could have been Mars for all that I knew. My brain was still an empty vessel. I cut out that photo and I glued it to my fourth grade school folder. I was a daydreamer and I stared at that photo all the time, but I had no context for it. About a decade earlier in 1974, the cover of Surfer magazine published a photo of a different tropical fantasy wave. The title story was about a forgotten island of Santosha. It was this photo that sparked the imagination of Kevin Levette, a young surfer from Australia. But the article didn't contain a map or information about an island. Instead, it teased Santosha as not an actual place, but a forgotten state of mind. This seemed like a challenge to Levette's imagination. And after years of long drives to the Gold Coast that usually ended with crowded and poor surfing conditions, Kevin and his best mate, John Geisel, decided to search for an actual forgotten island. At that time, in the mid-1970s, Bali had already been discovered by surfers, and the rumor was it was already becoming crowded. Kevin and John bought a two-man tent, a Super 8 camera, three surfboards, and a map of Southeast Asia. Sumatra was at the opposite end of the Indonesian archipelago, and it seemed to be the logical alternative destination to search for something new. They arrived in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, in March of 1975, which somehow seemed like a fine place to start their search. In the mid-1970s, there was a popular route from Bali to Kathmandu, nicknamed the Hippie Trail. At that time, it was a much different scene in Asia because of the radical political changes and the Vietnam War. The laws about marijuana and opium were hazy, so the pair meandered along the trail, fully enjoying Penang, Thailand, and Laos, and almost allowed themselves to be swept up into the oblivion of that era. In Penang, they met an Australian surfer who had been on a boat that sailed past Nias Island. Even though he didn't have his board, he could see the backs of waves breaking. This breadcrumb re-sparked their original quest, and fortunately, their hippie trail ended in central Sumatra at Lake Toba. It's one of the largest lakes in Asia and was formed when a volcano blew its top off. One evening when Kevin and John were having dinner, they noticed a hand-drawn map of Nias on the wall of the restaurant. In the southwest corner, there was a long bay called Lagundri. It seemed like fate was pointing in that direction. They continued over land to the port of Sibolga, where there was an overnight ferry to Nias in the city of Teluk Dalam. While loading their surfboards onto the ferry, they noticed two other travelers, a couple named Peter and Wendy. Peter seemed fascinated by their surfboards, and John was in awe of Peter. It turned out that Peter was the one and only Peter Troy, a legendary surfer and explorer also from Australia. This bit of cosmic synchronicity ignited their confidence. When they arrived in Teluk Dalam, the natural beauty of Nias was stunning. They could already see that the swell was pumping, but the waves they saw in the harbor were detonating onto dry reef. Teluk Dalam is 2 bays away from Lagundri and about 15 kilometers. So after a few days and some failed attempts to surf around Teluk Dalam, they set their sights on Lagundri Bay. The only problem was there was no direct route with public transportation. So Kevin and John borrowed bicycles and set off without their boards to see what they could find. The road out of Teluk Dalam ended after about 7 kilometers. So for half of the search, they had to walk with the bikes in the smoldering heat. They couldn't see much through the thick jungle, and after being jolted around on the rutted track, they finally arrived at the mouth of an enormous horseshoe-shaped bay. They stumbled onto the palm-fringed beach and were greeted with massive shorebreak and an ultra-shallow mechanical left-hander, which was later named the Machine. The real star of their attention was another 2 kilometers in the distance, where they could see what appeared to be massive walls of water peeling endlessly into the top of the bay. It was more than a mirage, so they quickly returned up to the track and tried to make their way to the other side. Up until then, they hadn't encountered many locals, but on the way through Lagundri village, they were met with stunned and excited faces. They soon had a crowd of 100 or more villagers tagging along behind. When they asked for directions to the wave, the group decided to show them the long way. They were led on a track up a steep hill and an endless set of stone stairs to the entrance of Botahili village. This was their first impression of a traditional Nias village, and they were enraptured by wood carvings of giant crocodiles and dragons, adorning massive stone tables and thrones. The traditional architecture reminded them that they were walking back through time. After an introduction to the chief, they used one of their few Indonesian phrases, "Dimana ombak," where is the wave? The villagers took them to the edge of a cliff, and the bird's eye view of the wave did not disappoint. When they were led back down the hill and through the jungle and onto the beach, they were met with a terrifying wave that was breaking entirely too fast and shallow. It took a few minutes to realize that they had overshot what they had previously seen by a few hundred meters to the west. Their temporary disappointment dissolved in the immaculate light of sunset when they finally stood in front of the most painfully perfect wave they had ever witnessed. After a smoke offering to Buddha, Kevin and John practically floated back to Teluk Dalam to describe to Peter what they had found and to arrange proper transportation for the next morning. Peter was the more experienced traveler and was able to find a beat-up, topless Land Cruiser. And on the morning of June 11th, the three Australians made their way back to Lugudri Bay. They were met with flawless 6 to 8 foot emerald green walls, windless conditions, and mist hugging the palm trees. After another burnt offering to the Buddha, the trio paddled out into a session described as the most significant of their lives. When describing what it's like to ride inside of a wave, it's easy to over-spiritualize the experience. That being said, if you've ever ridden the waves of Nias, it's easy to agree that the view from inside can change your life. Kevin spun a vivid tapestry of the events, marveling at the facial expressions of his friends from behind the folding curtain, noticing the church steeple on the hill at the moment of exit. He found joy watching drops of water shimmer off of John's beard as he emerged from the golden green caverns. Their maniac smiles punctuated milestone feats of athleticism. After surfing multiple sessions for the entire day, Peter helped John and Kevin arrange temporary accommodation in Lugudri Village. Their intention was to stay as long as possible, but Peter's plan was to find a different slice of perfection within the Commonwealth of Australia. So he gave them his Indonesian phrase book and bid them farewell. Once Kevin and John were alone, they settled into an exhaustive rhythm of gorging themselves on Lugudri's most abundant natural resource. Finding food and staying healthy proved to be their greatest challenge. The hike from Lugudri village to the point was cutting into their energy reserves, so they decided to look for somewhere closer to pitch their two-man tent. I need to emphasize that throughout all of Nias history up until this moment, the land in front of the waves at Lugudri Bay was stigmatized and nearly empty. There are three tectonic plates that converge not far off the coast, making it one of the most active places on the planet for earthquakes and tsunamis. Throughout recorded history, there's been countless destructive incidents. The elders and shamans' explanation to common people was that these natural disasters were the wrath of angry gods. Most of the villagers in South Nias lived in constant fear of the ocean and the large waves in the bay. And so at that time, there were only a few small huts, mostly used to store and smoke coconut husks and make copra. John and Kevin were able to find one of these huts that was just big enough for their two-man tent. They were able to get permission from a local named Sifarma. Sifarma and his uncle Maur were the only two inhabitants of the point at this time. They would later become significant characters in the future of Nias surfing. John and Kevin were able to establish a suitable campground, but finding a decent meal became the problem. Their surfing ritual became a novelty, which attracted the attention of villagers from all over the island. Kevin described an encounter with some heavy-looking men that seemed to belong to another world. When the warriors appeared at their campsite, the Australians tried to describe their intentions with sign language, hand surfing, and pantomime. They had almost no money and few possessions. After sharing another burnt offering to the Buddha, the fierce-looking men seemed to relax and eventually return to the jungle. What seemed like an insignificant and strange encounter would later be revealed as something dark and dangerous. The Australians' lack of communication skills and scarcity of proper meals was starting to build tension, so they decided to hike up to Botohili village and meet with the chief of the village again. As I mentioned in episode 1, similar to Elio Medigliani's technique of breaking the ice with a gift of tobacco, Kevin and John seemed to bypass any tension or miscommunication with burnt offerings to the Buddha, aka ganja marijuana. On this occasion at Botohili, the men were finally able to explain the simplicity of their true intentions, to just surf and stay as long as possible. The meeting ended with smiles and laughter, and a surprise impromptu feast. They also made a breakthrough in Lagundri village. A family was willing to cook them one meal per day. This allowed them to return to their routine of daily surfing orgies and stretch their 50 remaining dollars into 6 weeks of bliss. July arrived, and with it came a drop in swell and an increase in unfavorable wind and rain. It was difficult for John and Kevin to say goodbye to their discovery, but their money was nearly finished, so they decided to make their way to Bali. As I discussed in episode 1, the Nias experience has a way of following you like a shadow spirit. And while on a boat headed east, both of the men started to feel the effects of something serious. Chills and fever overcame them both simultaneously. The early signs of malaria became a stark reality. They made it to Bali and did their best to enjoy the emerging surf scene and recover from their illness. Kevin met his future wife there and returned to Australia, while John had some money wired to Bangkok and decided to try and travel overland from Thailand to Europe. When we share an intense experience with another human, it's impossible to know the ripple effect it can cause in our lives. When Kevin and John parted ways in Bali, that would be the last time they saw each other. John passed away from malaria within 9 months of their discovery. Even though Kevin and John made a pact to keep the wave a secret, Peter went on to tell one person, and that person told someone, and so on. Kevin was devastated by the death of John, but he wanted to share their experience again. So exactly 1 year later, he invited his new wife and her sister and brother to return to Nias. The group came more prepared this time and were able to focus on a symbiotic routine of camping, surfing, shopping for food, and preparing meals. The surf continued to pump. Kevin's wife Jan and her brother Bugs were astute campers, but the weather pattern was different that year, and eventually the skies went black, and 7 days and nights of rain assaulted their campsite. The arrival of another couple was not only a shock, but it also seemed to upset the fragile balance of their situation. Kevin described the couple in unflattering terms, a man overcompensating with bravado, and his girlfriend of Indian descent was naive and an inexperienced traveler. The torrential week of rain flooded the village of Botohili, washing the pig trough and excrement into the drinking well, which resulted in a cholera outbreak and the death of 11 villagers. Kevin started relapsing into signs of malaria, and Jan developed a serious leg infection. The new girl, named Ingrid, started experiencing stabbing pains in her kidneys, and after a breakup with her boyfriend and his sudden departure, it attracted the attention of the same fierce-looking men that Kevin and John had met the previous year. Kevin began to feel the guilt that comes with the realization that sharing your dream with others can also produce a mutual nightmare. After 3 months of alternating bouts of pleasure and pain, Jan started to experience fainting spells, and Kevin decided it was time to tap out. While he was searching for medicine in a ride back to Teluk Dalam, another torrential downpour flooded the river by Lagundri village. This intensified the entire situation, and while packing their belongings onto a copra truck, Kevin noticed a commotion forming next to a rusted-out shell of a pickup truck. Villagers from Lagundri and Botohili were arguing with the fierce-looking jungle men as they were trying to load a makeshift stretcher containing an incapacitated Ingrid into the bed of the truck. The chaos of the situation was overwhelming, and Kevin was disillusioned by the collapse of his dream. On the torturous ride back to the northern city of Gunung Sitoli, he vowed never to return to Nias, and was thankful to eventually make it back to Australia with his wife and in-laws still alive. As for the fate of Ingrid, it would be another 20 years until he discovered the true gravity of what had transpired. At this point in the podcast, I need to explain how Nias Island's conversion to Christianity spontaneously combusted. I realize that talking about religion can be an automatic turnoff for many listeners. But I promise, if you stay tuned, I will tie it back together and explain how bloodthirsty headhunters, power-hungry chiefs, and mystical shamans can embrace a hybrid form of Christianity that allowed surfing and surf tourism to blossom. After the anthropologist Modigliani's experience in 1886 led to peace between South Nias and the Dutch, a road was built and the missionaries could travel in safety. These missionaries worked tirelessly to devalue and dismantle the tradition of headhunting. The constant natural disasters and outbreaks of disease could no longer be explained away by the Nias shamans. The missionaries offered education in modern medicine, and once they properly translated the Bible into the language of Nias, the fertile ground was laid for change. From the missionaries' account at the time, the Great Awakening of 1915 occurred when local Nias Islanders took on leadership roles and began to preach to each other. They described widespread miraculous situations when converts were shaking uncontrollably, dancing, jumping, and speaking in tongues. There were hundreds of people enthusiastically confessing their sins, even acting them out in graphic detail. I grew up in a Pentecostal church environment, so I've witnessed some of these types of phenomena, and I can understand this perspective. The anthropologist Andrew Beattie explained the spread of Christianity throughout Nias with a more measured approach. He contends that the culture and origin myths of Nias before Christianity were explained by elite shamans who often went into a trance. They blamed the outbreaks of disease and natural disasters on spirit possession. In the most popular myth recounted by the elders, the island was settled by ancestors who were lower down from the upper world, bringing with them the ingredients of civilization, gold, pigs, and the weights and measures used in exchange. In Neos cosmology, things of value were not manufactured. They fell from the sky. Neos mythology also provided an explanation for the loss of wealth on the island. The original man named Hea was sent down from the upper world by Lo'Walangi, the giver of breath. When Hea passed away, his heart was put in a flask, and it became the nagging conscience and judge of Neos society. The heart dictated the rules of weights and measures, profit and loss, and the primal sin being taking something that didn't belong to you, especially adultery. When Hea's heart caught his daughter-in-law cheating, she took the flask and threw it into the river. The heart drifted out to sea and traveled to the land of the white man, taking with it the knowledge of the sources of wealth. These stories naturally produced an environment of fear and emotion. This provided fertile ground for Christian conversion, especially when the Bible was translated into Neos language. The missionaries took the mythology stories and hollowed them out and filled them back up with their counterparts from the Christian Bible. That biblical world of priests, healers, warring tribes, greedy chiefs, seers, lepers, and lawgivers is one that they easily recognized. The missionaries' constant reminders about their sins of human sacrifice, burnt offerings, ancestor worship, and even salvation were strangely familiar to Neos people. Lo'Walangi, the ruler of their upper world, became Jehovah God, the creator. Hea, the original man, became Adam. And the natural way Neos people referred to themselves, Ono Niha, was perfectly translated to Son of Man, a term Jesus used to describe himself dozens of times throughout the Bible. The missionaries described the Great Awakening of 1915 as the Holy Spirit descending upon the people of Neos. Anthropologists explained it as a shock effect. The sense of something incredible was the catalyst for conversion to Christianity. Because their past beliefs were laced with fear and emotion, they simultaneously experienced repulsion and attraction when confronted with the stories from the translated Bible. Jumping forward to 1975 and the arrival of the Australian surfers, the locals of Lagundri and the surrounding villages were shocked to witness the young men riding the terrifying waves of the bay. What could be the source of their bravery? And what was the reason behind their rituals? They slept only a few dozen meters from the high tide mark. Was the revelation of riding waves similar to Neos Islanders' acceptance and conversion to Christianity? It's difficult to remember what it's like to witness surfing for the first time, but especially through the lens of a dozen generations of taboo and fear. While Levette and Geisel were immersed in the ecstasy of flawless surf, Kevin was to discover 20 years later that they were actually balanced on the precipice of destruction. Even though in 1976, after he vowed never to return, curiosity won back Kevin Levette's heart. In 1996, he agreed to return to Neos by invitation of the Association of Surfing Professionals, who were hosting surf competition in Neos. Levette was shocked to see that the locals of Lagundri had fully embraced surfing, and now brazenly built their guest houses, called Lossmen, on stilts that reached past the high tide mark and onto the reef. Competition for waves was equally matched with the fierce battle for tourist dollars. From Levette's perspective, he didn't focus on the negative point of view about a crowded lineup. He was more concerned about the land management and the disappearance of the natural landscape of the jungle, which no longer met with the sand. After the contest was finished and the competitors went home, he was able to enjoy the majesty of the waves and their unchanged perfection. It was on his last night when he decided to catch up with his old friend Sifarma, the local who had allowed them to stay in his coconut hut. Sifarma was now in his 40s and had never been one to lie or exaggerate. The story of what was going on behind the scenes after their arrival in 1975 would be a shock to Kevin's system that would rival even the news of John Geisel's death. The heavy-looking men that visited their tent, those fierce-looking warriors that looked like they stepped out of another world, turned out to be some of the few remaining headhunters and their shaman, Nadia the Hornbill Man. The hornbill bird is rare in Indonesia, but unmistakable. It looks like a toucan, mated with an eagle, and then sprouted a small rhino horn on top of the downward curving beak. Nadia was thoroughly feared throughout Nias, and was believed to be a practitioner of red magic. It was rumored that he had the ability to kill just by touch, and was able to inflict disease by casting spells. Sifarma was shopping in Botahili when he overheard Nadia in his desire to chase away the foreigners camping in front of the wave. He also mentioned the reconstruction of a suspension bridge between Botahili and Lagundri. The bridge needed a skull to be buried under the foundation stone in order to properly consecrate it. Rumors and fear began to spread throughout Botahili and Lagundri. Sifarma described to Kevin the day Nadia appeared in Lagundri Bay. It was as if he arrived from thin air and made his way up to the Australians' two-man tent. Sifarma and his uncle Maur crept up within listening distance and hid behind a tree in order to eavesdrop. They listened to the awkward exchange between surfers and shaman. They watched the sign language, the smoking, and they realized that while Kevin and John were trying to explain surfing and their motives to stay on the point, Nadia was trying to tell them he was looking for a skull, preferably a woman's. When the meeting was finished, Sifarma intercepted Nadia the Hornbill Man and asked him what he wanted with the foreigners. Nadia reconfirmed that he wanted to get rid of the Australians and find a skull to consecrate the bridge. Sifarma said Nadia's eyes were the color of blood and terrifying. He said to the shaman, "Why are you bothering them? All they do is ride on those boards all day long." The shaman brushed him aside and disappeared back into the jungle. A few weeks later, just after the Australians had left, Nadia returned with three other warriors. They were incredulous after learning that Kevin and John had returned to their country. They just couldn't accept it, so they kept returning to the bay every 2 weeks for the entire year. When Kevin and his group returned the following year, Nadia and his men arrived with new enthusiasm. Kevin's wife had blonde hair, which was mesmerizing to anyone from Nias, but the Hornbill Man seemed especially enraptured. Whenever the men appeared in Lagundri, Sifarma and his uncle would silently trail the shaman and his crew. Some of the villagers of Botahili also felt protective of the foreigners, and they would quietly make their way to the coconut plantations overlooking the bay. Fully armed with their traditional swords and spears, pretending to harvest coconuts, but silently watching from the tops of the palm trees. Sifarma explained to Kevin that on another occasion, he overheard the conspiracy between Nadia and his men. They wanted to capture the women, but the Australian men were tall and sturdy looking. This conflict could be won, but the problem would be safely escaping with the women. Nadia and his men were aware of the armed men from Botahili and Sifarma and his uncle. They just couldn't agree on a plan of escape. They argued among themselves for what seemed like hours, but finally left visibly frustrated. When the new tourist couple arrived on the scene, it caused the upset and balance that Nadia and his men were waiting for. Ingrid, the naive girl of Indian descent, became the new fixation for the hornbill man, especially after an argument and breakup caused her boyfriend to leave. The chaos of bad weather, an outbreak of illness, further disrupted the campers. When Kevin and his group decided to leave, it was the opportunity Nadia and his warriors were waiting for. While Sifarma explained this alternate reality of the situation, Kevin's memories came flooding back. The pouring rain, the rush to load their baggage on the copra truck, the intense argument between the Lagundri village and the serious-looking jungle warriors, the makeshift stretcher, fear for their health and safety. It was intense and overwhelming. Sifarma broke the silence and asked, Kevin, what happened to Ingrid? They finished the bridge in 76, so they must have found a skull to consecrate it. Understandably, this revelation rocked the foundation of Kevin's equilibrium. He had no idea what happened to Ingrid. After he regained his composure, his next logical question was, why didn't you tell us that we were being stalked by shamans and headhunters? Sifarma answered as if he had already thought through that question. We were just getting to know you and didn't want to chase you away. We were intrigued by your presence and wanted to learn from you through your surfing lifestyle. Sifarma and his uncle Maur had expected at least one or more of the surfers would not survive. But they also believed that the men had finally broken through the taboo surrounding the bay. If you've ever spent time in Nias, the logic of Sifarma's answer might make more sense. There are times when questions become more like feelings or emotions. Why have I traveled so far in search of waves? Why does surfing seem so important? This is a risk to my safety, my health, and my relationships. Through some people's eyes, we're just playing in the water or taking a bath in the sea. When I walk down a trail carrying a surfboard and I cross paths with a villager from Nias, sometimes I feel ridiculous. But on the walk back, after riding inside of waves, it feels like the most important accomplishment in my life. Why is this? Is it because for a few seconds I controlled the time inside of a liquid tunnel and I felt connected with God, the creator of the universe? These questions are the core reasons for this podcast. I'm trying to conceptualize where surfing belongs among science, religion, and technology. I don't want to over-spiritualize the act of riding waves, but there have been some intense experiences while surfing and traveling through Nias that have shaped the course of my life. In episode 3, I'm going to tell you about my personal adventures in Nias and the surrounding islands. I'll tell you about unforgettable friends that have passed away from disease or injuries while chasing our mutual obsessions. I'm going to interview a local Nias surfer that was born during the era of the island's budding surf culture that we witness today. Thank you to everyone that listened and took the time to give me some feedback about episode 1. Whatever podcast platform you're listening from, if you could take the time to subscribe and rate this podcast, then you'll be the first to know when a new episode comes out. And it will also allow me to climb in the ratings and other people can find it. If you want to go a step further and write a review, I would greatly appreciate that too. Whether it's positive or negative, I'm an adult and I can handle it, and I crave honesty. I'll include links to my references in the show notes. My main source was an article from the Surfer's Journal called Custodians of the Point by the one and only Kevin Levette. You can follow me on Instagram or Facebook at Phil Goodrich Art. Sawagulu. That's how you say thank you in Nyos.